This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome, everybody, to UCTV's four-part television series entitled Global Warming: Change Begins with Learning. This series is co-sponsored by UCSB's Donald Brand School of Environmental Science and Management and the Community Environmental Council. Funding has been provided by the Global Climate Change Science and Society series here at UCSB. In other shows, we've talked about a number of climate change issues, including public policy impacts, resource productivity, and a variety of ecological issues. But today, we're talking about the important link between water, and I'd like to welcome into the studio our two guests, Professors Leibkap and Tagg. Thank you very much for being here. By way of introduction, my name's John Clark. I'm a board member at the Community Environmental Council in Santa Barbara, one of the co-sponsors. CEC has a fossil-free by 33 program that's very associated with climate change issues, and for people that want to know more about that, you can tune into our website at cecsb.org. But you two are the main event. We really want to talk about your experience and your work in this very important issue. And perhaps you could begin by introducing yourself to our audience, and then we'll start the conversation. Who would like to go first?
Great. I'm Christina Tagg. I'm a professor at the Donald Brand School here on campus. And my research mostly looks at the impacts of climate and land use change, actually, on water. Particularly terrestrial water, so on stream flow, on the amount of water we have in the soil. And I also spend a lot of time looking at how changes in water will affect plants and ecosystems.
Great. And I'm Gary Leibkap. I'm a professor also in the Donald Brand School and also in the Department of Economics here at UCSB. And I'm particularly interested in the policy or institutional response to water issues, water allocation issues. I work on water markets, water trades, and really how to more smoothly move water from traditional agricultural use to meet increased demands, urban and environmental.
Okay, I imagine it's a changing world out there for both of you in your research areas with issues of climate change, I would guess. Well, let's talk about a little bit about that. You know, through the media, climate change is now an issue that's out there a lot more. We hear about impacts, connections with hurricanes, changes in bird migration. But at least myself, I actually haven't heard that much about this important link between climate change and water. And so maybe starting talking about nature, ecology, what kinds of things can we expect to see out there with climate change and the flows of water in nature?
You know, at a global scale, people have shown that with an increase in temperature, you essentially intensify the hydrologic cycle, which means in some places you'll actually get more rain. But that's only in a few specific parts of the globe. But water is very related to temperature. One way we often think about that is if things get warmer, snow melts at a different rate. Glaciers start to melt. People have talked about the rising ocean levels. All of those things are related to water. So at a global scale, we see changes in really when water is available. And that really links to ecosystems because ecosystems, just like us, are very dependent on water. So when, for instance, if you start melting snow earlier, you make water available for the plants at a different time. And that can really impact their production and which species is likely to dominate, which species are going to be vulnerable, as well as when water is available for our uses.
So can you give some examples of how that might play out? I mean, it's still slightly esoteric. So water is earlier. So what? I mean, why does that matter to a bird or a fish?
Well, you know, the first thing that it matters to are plants. And since birds and fish are all dependent on plants, it's one way to think about it is to look at how the plants are affected first. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine that in places that have summer drought, California is a good example of that, where things are very dry in the summer, plants are dependent on how much water was available through snowmelt in the spring. By the time things get to late summer, things can get very dry. And if that water falls as rain and melts off earlier, then by the time you roll around to late August, there's very little water available. And for some plants that have adapted to having water later in the year, this reduction in the availability of water will impact their productivity. It will make them more vulnerable to other stress, more vulnerable to disease and insect outbreaks. And one thing for sure, it will make them more vulnerable to fire. You can imagine that if plants are drier, we're more likely to see more frequent fires, potentially more intense fires, which of course have big impacts on, say, forests and also all of the plants, animals, and birds that live in those forests.
So snow has kind of acted as kind of a water delayer in a way, holding onto the water for a period of time and parceling it out. And what you're saying is less delay, more water sooner, and then so some plants that really wanted to have that in May or June or whatever aren't going to get it. So that does sound like a huge impact.
It is. You know, one way to think about snow is like a dam. And for the very reason that we construct dams to try to even out the time distribution of water. If you think, why do we build dams? We build dams to reduce the risk of flood and to increase the availability of water later in the summer and dry periods when we need it. Snow does that for us. And the problem is we can't build dams everywhere. And, you know, we can't build dams in the soil. So effectively, snow acts like a dam, and if you remove that snow, it's like taking out a dam.
I've never thought about it that way. That was fascinating. And there are certainly other areas in the tropics that are connected with a monsoon dry cycle. I mean, can you imagine that changing as well with climate change? Is it going to be more intense, delayed in the sort of non-snow-based water systems?
In the non-snow-based water systems, generally, what we're expecting is to see more intense precipitation events, so greater risks of flooding. There's also, as things become warmer, we may also see higher rates of evaporation, and we're still working out, as scientists, really what that's likely to mean for those ecosystems. But certainly more intense events can have implications for things like stream flow. So, for instance, here in Southern California, we don't have snow, but we would expect more intense storms, which would have implications for flooding. It also tends to increase the risk of things like landslides. But the effect on ecosystems is a little bit more difficult to tease out, so we're really working on that yet.
Now, are we imagining that a place that was, you know, a desert for the last several hundred years of all of a sudden is going to get a bunch of rain and it's going to be a forest? Are we talking about water moving all across the globe and being in places where you don't expect it, or is it really just intensifying the existing pattern?
More or less, you're just intensifying the existing pattern. The biggest effects are likely to be in the high-elevation, snow-dominated, high-latitude systems. Mm-hmm. There, you can imagine if you shift from a primarily snow-dominated to a rain-dominated system, that's a big change. So hydrologically, those are likely to be the most sensitive areas. Mm. You're not going to see deserts suddenly becoming tropical rainforests or tropical rainforests suddenly becoming deserts. It's not going to be like that. But particularly in the northern latitudes, if you go from a place that was dominated by snow or was continually fed by a glacier and that goes away, you will see some dramatic changes in the hydrology.
And I would imagine that would change the species dependent on that system. I mean, it would be an immense change. It's not, the snow is gone. Everything would change with that.
Right, because the snow has essentially provided a seasonal pattern of the availability of water. So you will start to see changes. How dramatic those shifts will be in ecosystems, again, we are still working out in terms of details. Mm-hmm. Particularly because the biggest changes for ecosystems may not necessarily be that, okay, we're getting more frequent drought, but the stresses that are related to that drought. So a system that undergoes more stress, just like, you know, you can think of yourself, if you get stressed, you're more likely to get a cold. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's by analogy. If you're stressing these systems, they're experiencing drought more frequently. It makes them more vulnerable to things like fire and insects and disturbances. So it's hard to work out exactly what will happen, but we know that they will be more vulnerable.
Have any stories you could tell of how it might be? I mean, we in California love the Sierras and understand how that works. So I you know, go up to Yosemite or go off to Mammoth or Tahoe? What am I going to see that's different? Will I know 20 years from now, will I notice that it's different?
Well, do you ski?
Okay, beyond that.
Well, that's one of the big impacts is, you know, because this is related hydrologically to the availability of snow, a lot of places that, you know, are currently ski resorts will experience much more frequently winters where you don't have snow. So if you ski, yes, for sure you'll notice a difference. In terms of water supply, you will start to see a difference. And Gary can speak to this, too. We have ways of trying to regulate the availability of water that, to some extent, buffer you from seeing these impacts, at least in the short term. We're already seeing more frequent summer drought. We're already seeing reduced summer stream flows throughout most of the western U.S., and that is important for the fish that live in the water, for the agricultural irrigation uses of that water. We already see trends in reductions in summer stream flow. We have all kinds of mechanisms for essentially dealing with the year-to-year variation. Hydrology is tricky because, you know, one year always looks a little bit different from the last year. Mm-hmm. It's more that you're starting to see more frequent occurrences of these low water availability situations in the Sierras, in the Pacific Northwest, in Oregon, in Washington, throughout much of the mountainous western U.S.
Well, I want to talk about agriculture in a second, but one more ecological question. In terms of the aquatic environment, we as a society are spending a lot of money trying to restore some of those riparian habitats and protect fish and fish habitat. I mean, what does it mean for literally millions of dollars invested in trying to bring back those systems or hold on to those systems? I mean, will the steelhead come back to Santa Barbara? Would this change? And you know, in the Pacific Northwest, you know, salmon is a big deal. So what? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, one thing, if there is a lesson to be learned from climate change, it is that we've tended to design our preserves, our restoration strategies, our way of conservation around assuming that climate will stay the way it is. Mm-hmm. If you want to start designing conservation, restoration, given a changing climate, you have to take a lot more into account, right? You have to start taking into account that, okay, for certain fish, if things get warmer, then they need to have other places that they can go. They need refuge that at colder temperatures. That means, in a sense, you have to design larger reserve systems so that they're, you know, ecosystems to some extent can respond to climate change, but you have to give them room to respond to climate change. And because we've often restrict our reserves, you know, our national parks, we don't necessarily allow for the system to respond to these changes. So I think these systems are vulnerable, and our conservation strategies, we really have to rethink them now in the face of a potentially changing climate.
Those are significant changes. You're talking about massive changes of scale for conservation, and we haven't been doing a good job at that.
Yeah, we need to start thinking of, you know, both for human water resources and our availability of water and for preserving our ecosystems that depend on them, exactly as you say, at a larger scale. So we're allowing for the variability of environments that these organisms are going to experience. We want to take that into account.
Well, let's talk about some of the human impacts, and maybe we can start with agriculture. You know, the San Joaquin Valley is completely dependent on water not from the San Joaquin Valley to grow what's there, and that's, you know, one of the breadbaskets of the western United States, et cetera. So what can we look at in terms of agricultural economies and food production and those things that we rely on?
Well, Christine has really highlighted on key issues. Water is likely to be more variable in supply, so it's going to be harder to predict. It's going to change its pattern of availability, even if overall throughout the year it's the same. It's going to make storage issues much more difficult because without snowpacks, then we may have to have more reservoirs, and already we have difficulty. Agriculture is going to be particularly, I think, stressed about this because there's already increased demand on water that's used in agriculture for other uses. Agriculture uses about, depending on the area and the state, about 80% of the water. And we've grown up as a society really in a system of abundance. Water has historically been cheap. We've had abundant plants and animals, and you know, we just live in a society that's been rich. And what's happening increasingly, particularly over the last 15 years or so, is that we're running into limits, and water is becoming increasingly scarce. We want water to do a lot of things, to provide for people living in our booming western cities. And we want to rewater sections of the San Joaquin. We want to provide for enhanced ecosystem habitat, as Christina has mentioned. We value the environment and recreation much more. We want to have trout streams. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to raft. We want all those things. At the same time, we want to maintain access to abundant food supplies. And we have a whole society, a whole economy, particularly in California, but really throughout the West, that's built around irrigation water. And a lot of those systems were put in the 1930s. And so climate change is going to make those old arrangements a lot less workable. And we're going to have new ways of making them a lot more flexible and to be able to reallocate water more smoothly and quickly than we have been able to in the past.
I don't know if you're willing to talk specific crops, but you know, you go, you know, up to the Bay Area, you go Highway 5 through the state of California, and it's agriculture, and in many cases, from what I understand, the economics for some of those are a little bit dicey anyway. The food market is global. Mm-hmm. Are you thinking that some of those, and with the margins being so small, having one input become more expensive or harder to get, more expensive because you have to put in more reservoirs, or less certain because of change patterns, that could really make a difference for, I would imagine, some of these farms, and particularly some crops that are very water dependent. I mean, I think of rice.
Yeah, no, rice
so,
is the...
So, I mean, could you talk about some of those specifically?
Rice is the poster child for water-intensive crops, but cotton, we grow a lot of alfalfa. The problem has been, historically, that since water's been cheap, and we've had the beneficial use doctrine that really requires that if you have a water right, you have to use that water, otherwise you
can
lose
it. Can you explain that, just because?
Well, in the West, water is dominantly allocated through a property rights system called the appropriative doctrine. And so basically, the first party to claim water, and this primarily applies to surface water, but to some degree also to groundwater, the first party to claim a certain amount of water had the right to that, the high priority right, and then that party could divert the water and move it from the stream through irrigation canals and so forth to their crops. And that's, of course, what irrigated agriculture in the West is all about. And because farming, along with mining, were really the first things that were done everywhere in the West, virtually, the high priority water rights are in agriculture, typically, most of the water. And on that basis, you could grow rice or cotton or whatever. Now we've added, as you note, some heavy doses of subsidies and whatever to these things, so that in some cases they're no longer economic if they didn't have the subsidies. But nevertheless, people actually grow these crops. Communities are built around them. Agricultural service organizations are there, and so forth. And so there'll be real impacts as we move out of water. But the good news, I think, is that as water has become more valuable, it forces all users, whether they are current users in agriculture or potential users in urban areas or in environmental, to measure more carefully exactly how much water they really need, because it now has an opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. And California has been one of the leading states in terms of refining its water rights doctrine so that other things count for beneficial use. Because it used to be, and it still is in some places, that if you conserve water, the conserved water can be taken by the next priority user. And so it reduces your incentive to use it very effectively.
Do you think there is more of a culture towards water conservation in agriculture? Is that now a given? That that water needs to be conserved because it's more scarce, or culturally speaking, in agriculture, has that grown?
Oh, I think so. Farmers are very attuned to how much it costs them to grow crops or raise livestock. They're very attuned to trade-offs, and when urban areas are willing to pay 10 or in some cases 100 times or more per acre foot of water for urban use relative to what the farmer is, the value of the water to the farmer, well, it doesn't take rocket science for them to realize that they can make some money by shifting that water, and society benefits. But at the same time, we need to have policies that facilitate that. Mm-hmm. Some of those transfers out of agriculture to urban will have very little impact on an agricultural area, because you could take the very low productivity water, low-valued crops, and so forth out. So if it's small amounts you move, probably no big deal. If you're moving more, then you could have some important impacts on the community, and therefore then we'd need to figure out how to compensate. And then there's a point on that, too, that Christina can speak to, and that is farmers to take advantage of opportunities to sell water can sell their surface water, and that water then gets released and goes down a canal system or the river or what have you to be then used by an urban area. But if they then replace that surface water by in more intensive groundwater pumping, then they deplete local aquifers, which have important effects on riparian habitat, as well as draw down on all of their other neighbors who are using it as well.
And we've seen a little of that, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Even without climate change, many parts of the western U.S. are relying on groundwater resources in a non-sustainable manner, essentially depleting their bank account. Aquifers are recharged by precipitation, but only at a given rate. And if you take more water out than is going in every year, you deplete your aquifer, you deplete your resources. And that has many different implications. It certainly means that sooner or later you're run out of water, so you can't depend on this forever. But it also affects, ecology. It draws down the groundwater table. It affects riparian habitat. In places that are coastal on the East Coast, we see saltwater intrusion. If you draw down your groundwater table enough, you change the balance between the level of the groundwater, the freshwater groundwater, relative to the sea, and so you start bringing salt water into your aquifer, which I'm sure farmers don't want to see salt water in their aquifer. So there's these sorts of things would happen even without climate change. But with climate change, if you start increasing your evaporation rates and your water use as a result of the warmer temperatures, then you will see an increase in this effect. And it's already a problem.
And, the story you're telling makes me think about Phoenix or Tucson and the just incredible sprawling suburbs around those that are, I believe, mostly based on groundwater projections.
Right.
And so, in terms of sort of the next step on this issue, what is going to be the impact on urban areas, particularly, I think, of the western United States, where we're probably stretching our water supplies anyway.
Yes.
And a lot of people live out here, a lot of economic activity is out here, and that's where most people live. So what are city folks going to feel? Will city folks notice a difference?
Higher prices.
Higher prices? What kind of higher prices?
Well, I just moved here from Tucson, so what that means. Just to give you an example, other than my mortgage payment, my water bill was my highest house payment.
Wow.
This was for a house for a family of four, no lawn. We did take baths on occasion and wash dishes and clothes when necessary. But our average water bill is probably $200 a month. All that said, so I'm actually, so long as water prices are allowed to adjust in urban areas, I'm pretty confident Tucson already has among the lowest water use per capita of any Western city, for sure. Phoenix has more water because it has surface water as well, the Salt River. So water prices are lower there, and Phoenix is much more water intensive per person, or has much more water intensive use. They have lawns there. Looks like an oasis. Tucson mm-hmm. looks like a desert town.
You know, actually, in my experience in those two cities, you can, I think, I may have been imagining it, but Phoenix felt more humid.
Yeah, well, it is.
You know,
it
there,
is.
There was a visceral difference in terms of the desert air or not.
Right. But I think you can feel some confidence. What Christina has outlined is a more intense problem that adds a lot of uncertainty through climate change in terms of water supplies, when they'll be available, and a more serious impact on the riparian habitat and hydrologic cycles and so forth. In terms of human use, I'm pretty optimistic in the sense that there's a lot of water that's in agriculture. Urban use, per capita use, is much lower. And it will not take a great deal of water taken out of agriculture to supply growing Western cities. So I'm frankly pretty optimistic about that. That doesn't mean, though, that this will be easy, because it's already hard. The negotiations between the Imperial Irrigation District, which uses the lion's share of California's Colorado water allocation, and California has the lion's share of all the Colorado River water. Those negotiations between the Imperial Irrigation District and the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California have drug on for years and years and years, just because of all of the related stakeholders and potential parties, and the amounts of money at stake are huge. With San Diego offering, in some cases, $500 an acre foot or more, and the farmers pay the conveyance costs of maybe $15 an acre foot. So you can see the need. On the other hand, community-wide impacts are a concern. The impact by adding, for example, an unanticipated impact. They lined the All-American Canal, or parts of it, so that the seepage would be reduced. Mm-hmm. And then allowed, that seemed like a win-win, that conserved water then could be taken, sent to San Diego, and we wouldn't have to have any real impact on fallowing or crop patterns. But of course, that seepage went somewhere. And many of the farms on the Mexican side of the border actually had been accessing that groundwater, and suddenly it's not there anymore. So you do have these complicated impacts that have to be considered, and those are going to only be more difficult with climate change.
Well, and speaking of the Colorado River, if you read your Aldo Leopold and you read some of his writings about the Colorado River Delta, you know, at the Sierra Cortez, I mean, it's pretty much gone. Yeah. This incredible ecosystem. We're already not doing a great job. And so the thought of that getting worse is terrible. I mean, do you see any ability for jurisdictions to somehow negotiate better and maybe bring that ecological system back to the table? Or is this really getting into the place where people are going to be so fighting for, could this be a situation where people are so fighting for a more limited resource that things like the ecology are going to be even farther off the table now out of fear? Do you know the question?
No, I don't see it being pushed off the table. In fact, ecological values, environmental values, recreational values are all very highly valued in a rich society like ours, and particularly in California and the West. I mean, that's why people live out here. Mm-hmm. And so there is going, and the richer we are, the more we're going to want those things, because people have more free time. They also are more aware of what's going on around them, more environmental consequences, and people care about these things. So those demands aren't going to go away, but they're going to be climate. They're hard to solve already. You know that the issue over the refilling of Mono Lake, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, it took 20 years of very acrimonious battle between the city of Los Angeles that had the water rights and groups concerned about the Mono Basin and Mono Lake and its tributaries. Well, those problems are only going to be more difficult to deal with because we're going to have more uncertainty about water supplies, about the impact on third parties and so forth. So climate change will just make this more difficult. Environmental and ecological demands are going to be right up there, right along with urban demand. But I do think it means at the end of the day, agriculture is going to have less water. It's just going to be what happens. And so a policy menu that makes that smoother, less acrimonious, and addresses the various negative impacts on the various parties will be the order of the day.
And what kind of policy mechanism might that be?
Well, there's no one mechanism. I work on water markets, so now I will point out right away that water markets aren't going to be there to deal with everything. But traditionally, if a drought appeared, or during a time of drought, urban areas would impose mandatory rationing or whatever to deal with what they believed to be a short-term effect, and people really do step up to the plate and conserve and so forth. The problem is those policies don't deal with the long term, and so we need a way to more smoothly reallocate water, either on a short-term basis to meet some of the climate patterns that Christina described, or longer-term leases or longer-term sales. And those are hard. But the nice thing about them is that they allow the parties to negotiate. It forces parties on both sides to, since they have to buy them or sell them, they have to weigh exactly how much this water is worth. Not always so easy to do. But it does allow, particularly in the use of short-term, one-year leases, could be a very smooth way to meet short-term shortfalls in some areas. Mm-hmm. In the early 1990s, California adopted a very successful water banking system whereby water was purchased at that time by the state from agriculture dominantly, but to meet urban uses and so forth. And today in Arizona, Nevada is storing Colorado River water, basically, in Arizona for use in Las Vegas and so forth. And so water banks are a good place. They're just what they sound like. They're a place where you store water during good times to draw down upon during times when things are dry.
So is that a reservoir, underground aquifer, a big tank?
It could be any of those things. Uh-huh. In Arizona, of course, it's underground.
Right.
But it could be in Lake Mead. It could be any place. The notion is that during times of if a certain party has excess water, then they don't draw upon it, and they save it, and make it available to another party. There are a lot of other arrangements throughout the West that have developed over time to make these sorts of transactions more routine and fast.
But as you said before, I mean, every drop of water that is held in a reservoir, some ecology at some point a while back used to use that water in a different way in a different time. And are we, you know, what are the impacts of these kinds of systems that we've already put in place? And do we understand that? Oh, we're going to put another, we're going to water bank this here. I mean, water bank sounds great for us urbanites, but for an ecologist, that probably doesn't sound quite so good. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, sure. It's an interesting question. What do ecosystems need, right? And ecosystem uses of water, in a sense, are a little more complex than ours. Although there are some uses of water that your water banks won't deal with. So, for example, we use water for dilution. You may not think about that, but there's a strong linkage between hydrology and water quality. Right. So, for instance, something that the things you're talking about won't deal with in San Diego will be beach closures. And why do beaches close? Well, beaches close in San Diego often after a rainstorm because suddenly you're flushing all kinds of pollutants out of the system. That mechanism, where it's problematic in a place like San Diego, and with climate change we would expect more frequent flooding, But it's also a natural mechanism. Water moves stuff around. So the availability of nutrients, the availability of things we do want in the water, things we don't want in the water, is a function of how that water moves through the system. So water also supports riparian zone function, not just from the amount of water, but what the water carries with it. Mm-hmm. And any time you start changing the availability of water, it can have that effect. Some ecosystems actually need the system to flood on a frequent basis. And something that almost always happens when you build a dam or you have some way of storing water is you even out that distribution. That's the function of a dam, is just, you know, get rid of your high points and get rid of your low points. Many ecosystems are dependent on some years having floods to flush nutrients into the system, to change the ecology of the system, to move sediment around. If you start reducing the ability of the system to have flood events, to have stress events, then you'll change the ecology. So that's something to think about. We have to decide, in the end, we have to decide whose needs are we going to serve with the availability, with the resources that we have, and really, I think, list out what are those different needs. I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I think water policy tends to revolve around the people that develop policies to deal with water supply are different from the people who develop policies to look at the effects of flooding, are different from the people who develop policies to look at water quality, when really these things have implications for each other.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But I think that's also representative of a time of relative surplus, when water
right.
was cheap, when, you know, there's abundance. You could be an you could really be an expert in municipal water and really nothing else. And there are those people, and there are all those organizations. But what you're describing is that with climate change, these policies are going to have to change because things are so interdependent. And so back to the point about water banking, it might really matter where the water is stored and how often it's drawn down and so forth. And as I mentioned before, ecological values are valued in this society, and increasingly so. So why I said I'm optimistic about that, I don't want to say it's easy. It's not easy to get it, put a dollar amount on. And some people even object to that, but nevertheless, it can be done. People generally agree that it can be done and will believe in some of the values. And so the ecology is at the table, right along with urban demand, right along with agriculture demand, right along with recreational demand. Those are all legitimate demands, and they're trade-offs, and not everything is going to be perfect. And it's going to be, not like the old days. But, like I said, I'm optimistic that we can have fairly flexible policies because we're a rich society and we adopt fairly flexible institutions. We have, and we're in the process of doing that with water now.
I mean, I guess that this is probably way too much of a knee-jerk response, but, dams aren't that popular anymore.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
New dams are hard to make, and there's tremendous movement trying to get old dams out. You know, restore the Hetch Hetchy is kind of a big deal.
Uh-huh.
You know, and up in Seattle to restore the orca whales in the Sound, they know they need to take down the Alwa Dam because they need the salmon. You know, I mean, it's all connected. So it just sounds like, and one could say that the ecologists have been on the losing end of most of those discussions, and that might be changing in society a little bit, but the knee-jerk response is, oh, no, you know, now that headway's finally being made, now like you could talk about taking out the Hetch Hetchy, this is going to come, and it's going to throw it right back into the don't touch it. In fact, what we need is more. And, you know, I think a lot of people will find that a really frightening prospect. You know, progress has been made these last couple of decades, but, you know, when we as humans are afraid, we set aside some other values. So any comment? I mean, I'm glad you're optimistic. That makes me feel better.
That doesn't mean everyone's going to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important. See, one problem with water particularly is because it's been so abundant and cheap, trade-offs haven't been considered.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't had to be. And so you've had a lot of historical uses, a lot of relatively what we call today wasteful uses of water. those days are over with. And so there are ecological values and that society wants. At the same time, I think it's important to put city urban demand back on the table. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in Montana. I'm from a rural area. I'm not a city person, but nevertheless, if you read the water literature, and I'm talking primarily the sociological,
which most of us probably won't
economic.
Do. So thank you for doing
I'm sorry.
It. Most of us probably won't read that literature. So thank you for doing it.
Yeah. Well. Anyway, but generally in discussing water, cities, particularly Los Angeles, really don't are not described very positively. You know, it's usually described as sort of hedonistic, wasteful, and so forth. But you know, really, it's a small what people use in urban areas is relatively small compared to other demands. But my point really is cities are important. They are the place where the poor migrate to. It's where economic growth takes place, typically, that move people up. It's where technological change dominantly takes place. It's where universities are. So Hetch Hetchy, removing Hetch Hetchy might be a good idea on the one hand, but at the same time, we want to have alternative. Cities are growing, and conservation alone is not going to meet the demands for water in urban areas. There's going to have to be additional supplies, and if we're going to take water out of Hetch Hetchy or remove Glen Canyon Dam and so forth, then we got to have alternatives, mm-hmm. because the alternatives may turn out to be more ecologically damaging than what it is we currently don't like, and that has to be thought through because cities are important, people are important, and they have to have water too.
Well, I concur that cities are important. You know, it's interesting when you talk about cities, you keep coming back to water supply and mm-hmm. that, you know, really Los Angeles, maybe it doesn't use that much water in the bigger scheme of things. But if you look at water quality, it's hard to ignore Los Angeles. It's hard to ignore cities. Mm-hmm. You know, the hydrologic impact of cities is as much on what they put in the water as how much water they use. And I think, you have to include that in your analysis of how they use water. Urban runoff is a non-trivial mm-hmm. Component right. of the problems that we deal with, and something that I certainly current GCM suggests that we will get more intense storms with a changing climate mm-hmm. in Southern California, which mm-hmm. means this problem will increase, and it increases with the growth of cities, mm-hmm. right? And so just to bring the point back that water is more than just water supply. Yep. You really have to think of water as something that moves stuff around. Water is what connects one place to another in many cases. And I think I do have this feeling that a more integrated perspective on water is still needed within a policy framework. Because I do think that the people that look at water as a transportation mechanism and as a water quality are still pretty distinct from the people that look at water as a supply issue.
I agree with you completely. And that's the wonderful thing about the Brand School, is that it has this group of scholars that come from a variety of disciplines. But no, an integrative approach to water, as with most resources, is really important. And climate change only makes it more so.
And are there steps being taken anywhere you can think of to start doing that more?
Well, Christine and I have already been talking about joint research.
It's good.
We've been talking about the Fryant Dam, the rewater agreement to rewater the parts of the San Joaquin. You know, it took about 18 years for them to negotiate that. And you have a lot of some of the country's best agricultural land dependent on that. At the same time, we want more water in the San Joaquin to repair that riparian area, as well as to bring back steelhead and other migratory fish stocks that haven't been there for a long time. With climate change, those water supplies may be a lot more uncertain. The patterns, the cycles may be more intense, and it's going to make it harder to meet the demands of everybody.
Do we even have the mechanisms to make those decisions? It seems like, you know, the primary mechanism seems to be the court system in many cases. I mean, are we coming up with other ways to get everyone to the table and not negotiate without a gavel hanging over their head?
You have to do that, frankly, because litigation is sometimes it's unavoidable, but it's extremely costly. It takes forever. The Fryant Dam, as I mentioned, took 18 years. Mono Lake, over 20. All the time you're fighting, the problem's not being addressed. And it only gets more severe. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm optimistic about this, as I've said over and over. As water is more valuable and we depend on it more and we value ecosystems, there's no other way to do it but mm-hmm. to find a more responsive, faster, less contentious way to deal with these problems.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that bringing it back to something that you actually mentioned earlier, that some of these issues are a problem of scale. So, for example, if you look at, you know, how much water do we need to support salmon in the Pacific Northwest? Well, what is affecting salmon in the Pacific Northwest? Is it overfishing? Is it climate change? Is it dams? These are complex problems, and the answer often depends on which scale you look at it. Are you looking at a particular river and its particular fish population and its particular ecology? Or are you looking at sort of a larger scale? Are we maintaining fish populations? Are we maintaining the ecosystem services that we want over a large scale? And I think that's what makes it challenging in a policy context, because often the arguments are around, say, a particular river, when maybe we need to be thinking about these ecosystem services at a larger scale, particularly with climate change, where we need to be able to maintain, I think, a diversity of ecosystems so that there's the capacity of the system to respond to changing water availability and changing temperature. So just to bring it back to this scale issue that mm-hmm. I think is important.
Scale is a big problem because the jurisdictions don't overlap.
Right.
And in terms of governmental units, you have counties and you have water conservation districts, you have irrigation districts, and you have state governments, and they may have very different, and then federal agencies, and then Canadian. When you have the big scale that Christina mentioned, that only, you know, that adds to the parties that have different incentives and so forth, but it's a new age, and people have to line up and address the problem.
Well, and this is where I'll admit to being optimistic in that climate change, I think, because it is a global problem, it brings our attention to these larger scales, the scales that water and ecosystems are actually naturally organized at. And I think there is a potential to change with climate change as part of this new era, that we'll have, to look at it in a positive light, there is the opportunity to come up with institutional mechanisms that are at scales that are more appropriate for maintaining the ecosystem services, the water, the biodiversity that we're interested in.
So, we've been talking a lot in sort of the U.S., and particularly Western U.S., and then with this sort of Western North America perspective, and certainly one could have hope here, because it's a fairly wealthy region. We have high environmental values. And let's move the context a little bit. I mean, you talk about some of these major water systems that are in the Middle East or in Latin America, where the politics are different, where the economics are different. You know, are you as optimistic about resolving some of these issues in the the caucuses? I mean,
We can only hope. Mm-hmm. We can only hope that in the Middle East the issue becomes water mm-hmm. at some point, because that'll represent a lot of progress, frankly. It's more complicated in many regions, so we're pretty fortunate there. On the other hand, there are some interesting institutional innovations that would be important to examine from a research perspective. Chile, for example, has a very active water market, and it's the north part of Chile is very dry. The south part is very wet. They have a very vibrant agricultural community and economy, a growing place. Argentina, on the other hand, everything is centrally managed. And so there is no easy movement or trading of water. And so it would be interesting, frankly, to look at how those two really quite different arrangements work as climate change proceeds. Australia is facing more and more intense droughts and is being forced really to adopt all sorts of institutional innovations or experiment with them to see what they can do because they also have great Australian wines and we like Australian lamb and it's a wonderful place. And so, it's another. So there are lots of lessons to be learned elsewhere in the world. We're not the only ones.
And there's a real international research interest in working out these things. I was just contacted recently from some researchers in Colombia that want to look at some of the modeling work I've been doing to look at how changing climate and changing snowmelt will affect their summer water supplies. Mm. And so, you know, the Colombian government is actually funding research on climate change impacts on water. So I think there is an international level of interest in some of these issues. And people in, I can't remember where it was, it was somewhere in, it might have been in Brazil, they were looking at trade-offs between plantations growing more forests, right, to try to offset carbon. Mm-hmm. But that has implications for water because it turns out plantation forests use more water than your regular old growth forests. So you're kind of trading carbon for water. And it's people in Brazil that are really interested in how do we work out these trade-offs. So I think there's interest internationally. But I agree that in places where you have fewer resources to deal with the stress associated with climate change impacts on water.
So we're down to our last 3 or 4 minutes here. And in doing so, if you could just sort of either wrap up your, you know, how you would want to see us move forward from here on this issue, what are the 2 or 3 things we should all be thinking about, or, you know, or you could address the governor or the president. I mean, who would you want to talk to? What would you want to tell him if you had that elevator speech for him to say, okay, this is what I do, this is what you should do? What would you say? We'd like to start.
Well, I'm a strong believer in voluntary market arrangements whenever possible, I would want to urge the adoption of policies that facilitate smooth trades, that consider them as viable alternatives. At the same time, in addressing water managers and the people actually involved in these trades, the point that Christina mentioned, and this really, I think, affects all parties, and that is the scale and the effects across areas and species are often so large that these have to be taken into consideration because dealing with one small problem or one big problem in one place can have an important impact on others.
Christina?
I would second that. I think I'd like to see a geographic perspective on this problem, understanding that we have to look at climate change impacts on water at these larger regional scales, but then also within a region look at how what makes one system different from another, where we like to see the most dramatic impacts by really looking across different scales at how these effects on water play out. Mm. And across different systems, looking at ecology and human uses of water, looking at availability and water as a transport mechanism.
Well, I think this is interesting in terms of this series. This is the episode where we actually started talking about adaptation more than any of the others, of how we as a species, it's not about, you know, studying climate change or figuring out whether or not it's happening or what do you do to prevent it, but, well, what are we doing now that it's here? And I think this is going to be a growing area of work for a lot of fields, and this is clearly an important one. I want to thank you guys very much for being here. It was a great discussion, and thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.